The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I couldn't think of a title for this talk because it doesn't kind of come to me in that way. But it came to me this morning, and it's going to be about waking up, spiritual waking up, not getting up out of bed. It's not that, I think we all know how to do that pretty well. But this is a different kind of waking up, and I just have some thoughts about that that I'd like to share with you all. So where I'd like to start from first is when we are distracted, which is a way not to be with what's going on at the moment, with conditions, with, you know. And if we look at some of our distractions, I think we will all find that we are not always distracted for, you know, necessarily good spiritual reasons, but we're trying to escape, get away from the conditions as they present themselves. And this is normal stuff. And some of our distractions can actually be unhelpful. Some distractions can be problematic, and some can be really dangerous. So the example that came to me today was driving, which almost everybody does. And if you're going for a long trip, there's not much to do except sit there and drive, you know, go down the road and pay attention to what's going on. A few years ago, what I found out about driving is that distractions are up there with drug abuse, reasons for fatal accidents. So, distractions are now considered a really significant thing when driving. And the obvious problem with that is that you can have a really serious accident. But these are really simple things. Distractions, like, we're all probably thinking about cell phones. But there's other reasons that people are distracted while they're driving. They have their dog in the front seat, and so they'll lean over and pet the dog. Or they'll want something to drink, you know. And this can be really serious. And what I have found is that I don't have to be distracting myself because I'm bored, but it's actually a wonderful opportunity to sit still within conditions. You know, it's really relatively safe. It's benign. You're just driving down the road. But there's something about it, by bringing my attention to that kind of mundane, boring thing, that makes it okay for me. It's not clouded with boredom or, you know, when am I going to get there? Or, you know, thinking about things. I do that too, but I keep bringing myself back. And it's not like I want to stay in the moment all the time, because I think that is impossible. But it's when I find myself, as I do, is looking out the window going, oh, gee, there's a bird up there. I wonder what kind of bird it is, you know, and then my mind is going out that way. Or, because I'm always looking at stuff out the windows, I'm fascinated by a lot of things. And I just find that there's a noticing, but then not kind of going down that pathway, because it's really dangerous. And I don't know about all of you, but driving is a real good feedback. If you're not paying attention to driving, the feedback comes, like you go over to the right side of the road and hear that click, 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 click. Yeah, well, that's a sign you're not paying attention because you're wandering anyway. And there's other things too. So that was one thing that I wanted to bring up about really not being present and the ramifications or the consequences of that. And I found a story that I really liked about water that was a good example of listening, waking up and listening. And it's a story that takes, it's a true story, it takes place in Kenya, and I assume it's still going on. And it's about a semi-nomadic tribe in Kenya who they live through periods of severe drought, but this is seasonal. So they have times when there's lots of water going down the creeks and the water table level is fine and they can provide water for their families and for their cattle, because that's how they survive, that's their food and that's how they keep themselves alive. So what happens when it gets really dry, there's no more water in the creeks, is that these herdsmen need to dig wells. And the soil's really sandy, so they can dig down beneath the water table. And they dig these wells because they need water for themselves and for their cattle. And so when they're digging the well, they go down and they find these wells and they keep moving around, so there's not one place. And eventually they'll find a well by digging it out with buckets, you know, and shovels, and they'll dig down to the water table, and then they'll bring the water up bucket by bucket and put it in a trough for the cattle. And so while they're digging the well, they start singing. And the title of the story is called Singing Well. And so when they're singing, then these cattle are up on the hills and they're waiting, because they're thirsty and there's no evident water around. And so these men start singing, and this is very traditional. And it's interesting, each family within the tribe has its own song. So they're singing these hypnotic chants. This is what the story, you know, I'd love to hear the chant, but I couldn't find that. So they're singing as they're digging up these wells, and they go to great risk, because I don't know if digging in sand is not an easy thing, because the sides don't always stay stable. So they're taking a risk. They fill the trough up, and then they start singing, bringing their cattle to the troughs, like it's time to come and drink. And these cattle are just up on the hill, and they pay attention because there's all these different families that are also singing their individual chants. And the cattle don't just all rush to the first well that they see, but they actually, the story goes that they listen, like they perk up and they listen for their particular song. And so the words of the song are, let us be praised, let the grasses be praised, let the cattle be praised. So they're just—it's a song of praise to these to these cattle. So that what happens is the cattle then go to the right trough, and they're able to drink. And one thing that fascinates me about the story is that the water isn't always in the same place. But what they have to do is these cattle have to listen, and they hear this really hypnotic song of, this is where you need to go, and there's this element of trust. And I found that a spiritual story for me, that we need to listen, and we need to listen to that particular call for each and every one of us that we can respond to, so that we can drink the water of the Spirit or listen to something spiritual that is more than our own, you know, kind of mundane mind that just seems to be trapped by this. But this act of listening, we can wake up a little bit and get what we need. And I find that's true spiritually for myself. So the Buddha, as some of you probably know, the translation of the word Buddha is awakened one. And the definition that I found is awakened one is a person who understands that which leads to release from the cycle of existence based on the Four Noble Truths. No longer ruled by pleasant or unpleasant sensations and remains internally untouched by them. And what the Buddha found in his process of awakening was a lot of different spiritual dimensions, and I'm not pretending to second-guess what he understood, but I think, and I am guessing, that part of what he taught after he was enlightened is called the three spiritual insights, or the three marks of existence. And those are that the existence, there is existence of impermanence, there is existence of dissatisfaction, and there is existence of all beings, that we are all connected. We don't usually think of that as a spiritual insight, but what he was saying to me anyway is that there's teaching there for us that isn't, a dark, it's a good thing, it's a gift, the gift of impermanence, the gift of dissatisfaction. Most people wouldn't look at it like that. But, you know, I think that there may be something in there. There is something good to be found in all things, including dissatisfaction. And the existence of all beings that were connected without a real separation is, again, it's not. These are not easy lessons, but I think there's some real help that we can find there to help ourselves broaden our perspective, to widen our world, to really be founded in, impermanence does exist. Okay, that's really can be unnerving, and at the same time, it can be liberating. Because, like those cattle, you can't rely on always going to the same water hole. You gotta listen. You know, wake up and listen. And that's how you find what you really need. So, let's see here. Part of what we are trying to do in our lives is just to make sense out of it. And it's not an easy thing to make sense out of what life is, what it brings us, what we have to deal with always. It can just be really confusing. Fair enough. I have another story. But I just want to say a little bit more about the impermanence, or the three spiritual insights, is that I use that every day as a way to I don't think of myself as waking up after I think about impermanence, but I find that a really helpful thing, especially when I'm I've woken up because of something that is unpleasant in my life, a condition that is unpleasant. And the impermanence is there, and so is the dissatisfaction, and so is the, you know, that I can't get away from it. We're all connected, you know, we're kind of stuck in a way. But it's not that way at all, really. But I use that daily as something that helps me through my day. There's a bigger picture, and oftentimes my karma will supersede the bigger picture, and I feel stuck. And then if I feel too stuck, then I can start going down that pathway, and then impermanence comes up. And that to me is a gift, because it wakes me up and says, whoa, you're just going down the wrong path. You've been down this so many times. Is this where you want to go? And I say, no, I don't. Not so much anymore. So we're trying to make sense out of our world. We have senses. This is the way we understand the world, is through our senses. We see something, we perceive it, brain does that. And then we try to make sense out of it so that we can be happy, we can be at ease, be at peace. And it just doesn't work very often, for me, anyway, that I have that peace or that satisfaction that is is complete. I'll say that. Sometimes, I'm not saying this is all the time, but sometimes that is the truth for myself. And I wanted to tell you another story about confusion because I feel that that is something we all deal with, and it's fair enough that no wonder we can't find what we really want because situations are not straightforward. And this story is a story about a young man in Japan who happened to be in high school when it was World War II. And he was a literature student. He liked to debate ideas, you know, just kind of on a level of ideas. And he was really good at it. But during his high school years, it was determined that all the men needed to go to war, no matter what, you know, no exemptions at all. So all of a sudden, he's like 18 years old, and he has realized that he could possibly die. So the whole idea of death is right in front of his eyes. Okay, and the reason this was in Japan, like I said, and the motivation for these, they were primarily men, was about Japan was had the opportunity to become a great nation, a world nation. So there was this, and it was dependent upon everybody, you know, the military being supported into becoming a world power. So there was it was a good idea, you know, and people invested their lives and a lot of interest in this is what we need to do, this national identity. And then while he had been drafted, and then at the war ended right before he went to war. And what happened after that is then he heard the story of, everybody that was for the war in Japan now faces possible execution. And this threw him into a confusion of here's something that was really morally right, something you could, you know, die for. And then all of a sudden you were faced with the idea of being executed because you believed in the very same thing. Talk about confusion. And this was a young person, so he hadn't had a lot of time in the world to see things change, come and go. So then what happened is he and his age group then had a really hard time. They could not make any sense out of their life. The whole nation was under an identity crisis. They had no idea what to do, and they lost a lot of confidence in their own ideas of right and wrong. And I feel like that's, you know, fair enough. And so what he did was at some point he said to himself, you know, my whole life I've been so focused on ideas, you know, and debating them and being intellectual. He said, I'd never use my body. And so he said, well, you know, and some kind of things just rolled around in his brain. He just didn't have any idea what to do along with a lot of the young people of his age. But he decided to go to a Buddhist monastery. And the first thing was really interesting. The first thing that happened is his Zen Buddhist teacher said, well, do you think I have anything to teach you? And here he is thrown into this real confusing situation with is it right or wrong? And this teacher said, you can stay with me if you trust that I have something to teach. And so he just said, okay. You know, it wasn't like, I finally found somebody I can trust, and he just said, okay. So he goes for the first day, and the first day the teacher says, well, go out and sweep the patio. And, you know, there's a lot of leaves there, and so the young man does that, and he says, okay, and now I can throw everything away. But the teacher says, no, the first thing you have to do is take all the leaves out. We'll use that for fire starter. And then the young man says, okay, and then I can throw everything else away. He goes, no. And now we want to take all the bugs, you know, and take the rocks out. And then we'll have, separate everything out. So everything had a use. And this was so brand new to him, and he said, I don't know about all this. But there was something that he stuck with that situation. And he must have been really fed up with trying to figure out what was right or wrong. And he stuck with it, and he became a Zen master in his own right. But that was his beginning. How he came from confusion. And it wasn't like he was all of a sudden said, I found it, or I know what I'm going to do. It was just he basically didn't know what else to do, and he found himself in a Buddhist monastery. And he stuck with it. And in my own case, I have a pivotal point in my life that I realized was really significant. I hadn't realized it until just the other day. But I was taking a college and class, and when I was going to a university, and we were going on a field trip to look at tide pools that were along the coast and study the ecology of them. And I asked the teacher, because, in college you learn a lot of bits. You're reading, facts. That's all you're doing. It seems like you're putting all these, you're trying to, remember all these things. And I finally said, does all this knowledge that I'm learning, all these bits and pieces that I study so hard to remember, do they ever come together? And thank God, my teacher said, no. And it was true, that because it was just, you just study, I read so many textbooks that were just bits of information, and they never really came together. And so she said, no. And I went, oh. So that kind of just, my world caved in, and I decided, somehow, this is not what I want. Somehow all these things have to go in like a recipe. You put them all together. You mix them up, and then you have something that's wonderful. But that wasn't the case from the science classes that I was taking. I didn't think, anyway, at that point. So I bailed out, and then I was walking around thinking, well, okay. And I happened to see, I love it, I happened to see a poster for a retreat for Shasta Abbey. And I said, I'm going to try that. And so I did, and that was kind of the beginning of my journey here. And, there's just certain milestones throughout our lives that we turn around, and that was one for me. But again, I had no idea what I was getting into, and I didn't have that same experience as somebody saying, well, if you're here, you got to trust me or believe that I have something that you can learn from. I did believe that because I sure didn't have any answers myself. And some people think, well, that must be a really difficult situation to be in. Yes, it is. And it gets so difficult or so confusing that you kind of say, well, I don't know what to do. And that is actually a good place to be. Because then you can open to maybe the possibility of finding your way, that difficulty. But it's hard for people to really believe that. But once you've gone through it enough, then you can kind of trust that, again and again, I don't know what to do here. And you can find a way through because you're open. You've woken up to the moment and you're willing to let go of your thoughts, feelings, because you don't know. And saying you don't know is not a bad thing. That's the way we find our way through. That's how we can use impermanence, because we don't know how to deal with it. We don't know how to deal with dissatisfaction on one level. We don't know how to deal with just being all together all the time. We just don't really have good answers, good enough answers anyway, in my mind. Let's see here. In the Shobogenzo, Dogen writes, Truth is seamless, as it, Buddha nature, is not something composed of bits and pieces, i.e. of ideas, opinions, and emotions. These bits and pieces are not sewn together to make a whole of anything. They're not something we can really make sense out of. We can't understand the universe through our senses, because they're just perceptions. They receive signals, and we perceive those signals as a something through our brains. However, the Buddha awoke to truths that showed him a different way to look at life, awakened one, he was called. And that's available to us all. In Buddhist writings, it says, sentient beings whose minds are intent on the way do not see conditions as separate from the way. Endlessly there are conditions, endlessly we practice, endlessly.